Were a few of you doing air guitar during that? I thought I heard some people doing some air guitar in the back. No? Okay. We're continuing on in our series, Knowing the Biblical Jesus. We're to that point in Jesus' ministry, we're a little bit past half point. And so just to kind of recap where we're at, he's grown from this kind of unknown carpenter's son who's performing miracles and preaching the story of repentance to, as he's performed more and more miracles, his popularity has grown and grown and grown. And right now we're at the pinnacle of his popularity. Now, the problem with his popularity is that there are some who are there to see him for the message that he's sharing. There are others that are just there for the spectacle and the show. So part of it is there's just a popularity around him. The other is there's people truly searching for the message of what he's preaching. And today what we get the blessing to do is we get the blessing to go through the first recorded sermon of Jesus's. Now, what we have throughout the Bible is little snippets of stories and parables and things that he teaches. But today we're going to look at a full-blown sermon that is just awesome. It's just awesome. I mean, what I love about when Jesus preaches a sermon is it takes a normal human like 12 sermons to get through it. It's just that packed with wisdom, knowledge, power, authority, so many beautiful things. And so if you have your Bibles, go ahead and open up with me to Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. If you don't have a Bible, there should be one sitting in front of you. Go ahead, use that, and please, if you don't have one at home, take that with you, okay? So Matthew 5, chapter 1 through 11. This is the sermon called the Sermon on the Mount. It says, seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth, and he taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So let's just look at these statements here. First off, we call these statements the Beatitudes. Why? Because they all start with this statement, blessed are. Now, if we look at the Greek word, it's mariakos, which actually means to bring happiness. And so when we look at this, what Jesus is actually saying is not so much blessed are the poor in spirit, but happy are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Happy are, happy are, happy are, happy are. And so there's a few things here that are very key to this sermon, and I want you to make sure you pick up on the context of it. The first is do you remember back to Jesus' first public appearance? It was the cleansing of the temple. And do you remember how aggressive that was physically? Jesus makes a whip, he clears the temple, he flips tables, he scatters the crowd. It's a physically powerful moment. Well, as powerful as that was and as aggressive as that was physically, mentally and spiritually, this is the equivalent. This sermon comes in to wipe out the old, to push away man-made traditions that have defiled God's law and God's word and reestablish them for the purposes that they were made. Just as when he walked into the temple and he saw that this house that was built to bring glory to God is now being used to profit man, here he is going to speak about God's law that also was built to glorify God and is being used by the Pharisees to glorify themselves. And so I want you to imagine that same kind of ferocity that he tackled and emptied that temple with is the same kind of ferocity that he brings to this message here. It's a message that's profound, that's powerful, that's life-changing. And so the first thing I want you to get about this is just this statement itself. Happiness to. Happiness to the poor. Happiness to. Do you get most people back then didn't look at religion as a thing of happiness? Okay, let me just rewind a little bit. Do you get most people now don't look at religion as a thing of happiness? In fact, God himself isn't really one about religion. He's about a relationship between you and his son Jesus Christ. Now, what we have to be careful is some people throw the baby out with the bathwater. And what I mean by that is I see some folks who are so anti-religion that they throw away the traditions and the rituals that God himself established. And so I kind of always compare that as, yes, I love my wife, but would it be a smart move for me to go, well, since I love my wife, we're not going to celebrate an anniversary, I don't need to remember her birthday, I don't need to have any of these man-made things that help me acknowledge that I love her. You think that'd be a smart thing for my relationship with her? No, probably not, right? See, those man-made things that we put in like Valentine's Day, birthdays, anniversaries, they're tools that help me formally acknowledge the love that I have for her in my heart. Now, in religion, what the problem is some people, all they do is follow the traditions, and they don't have the heart behind it that makes it worthwhile. And so it'd be like the guy who's cheating on his wife but gives her a nice present on Valentine's Day. Does that really make up for what's going on? Not so much. Same thing for the person that doesn't acknowledge God on a day-to-day basis but goes to church every Sunday morning. Is God fooled by those behaviors? Absolutely not. And so what we see from Christ is the first thing we must have is the relationship. And only once you have the relationship do those traditions that God has given us become a valuable thing. An instrument, a tool that helps us acknowledge our love and our honor of who he is. And so what's beautiful about this first statement is Jesus is going to these people and he's acknowledging that your faith, your relationship with God can actually be a source of joy, of happiness. I think this is so profound because I don't know about you guys, but I go to a lot of churches in my life and a lot of them look like libraries. People are boring, dry, looks like they barely are getting through. You know, I mean, it's just like, is there any life here? I mean, last time I checked, we're here to do what? Glorify the most awesome creator and being in the universe and show him that we love him. Shouldn't that be kind of fun? Shouldn't that be exciting? I mean, just let's be honest about our own selves, right? Let's compare the excitement in this room this morning to the excitement at the AT&T Center when Manu Ginobili dunks a basketball. Same?
Yeah.
You think we're as loud as them? Okay, so that's not working from our end, but let's compare God to Manu. So what do you think's more impressive? God saying, let there be light and the sun appears, or Manu putting a piece of leather through a metal circle? Which one do you think has more significance on the history of mankind? Close, gonna go with God though, right? So what's the problem? Why is it that we cheer all the time? I mean, have you noticed lately, it's on TV, it's award season. Do you not see people's like utter desire just to worship? Hey, let's have an award show to tell all those singers how awesome we are because the millions of dollars we've given them isn't enough. Let's throw a party for them, analyze what they dress and wear, and then give them awards to go, hey, you're the best at this. I mean, the Academy Awards, do you realize we give awards for who pretends the best? We all pretended when we were kids, we grew out of it. Yet grown-ups who play pretend, we're like, those people are so great. They're awesome. I want to be just like them. Why? Because they spend their whole lives pretending not to be themselves? That's what we do in this world. We have no problem glorifying, honoring, or worshiping. We just completely and utterly direct it in the wrong places. And so Jesus looks at these people, and the beauty of the crowd that followed Jesus is, it didn't look like the regular church crowd. These were the rejects. These were the outcasts. These were the people that typically went to synagogue and got judged. And he looks at these people and he goes, a relationship with me, a relationship with my Father, is a source of happiness. And look at who he addresses. He said, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. He looks at this group of people that are rejects and outcasts and he goes, guess what? In real faith, in the real relationship with God, it is you who will find everything that you're looking for. So there's two profound things happening here. The first is Jesus is preaching a message of joy, of happiness. He's saying, don't you get it? A relationship with God is not something that should terrify you. It's not something that should make you wake up each day in fear. It's something that should bring you happiness, joy. It should make you smile. It should give you a bounce in your step. It should make you wake up with a vibrancy that nobody else has. And why? Because that happiness isn't from the external, it's from the internal. See, the people of this world, typically what you see about their lives is it's a roller coaster. You get a raise, you're happy. You get a promotion, you're happy. Oh, you're sick, you're sad. And so what you realize about these people that live by the ways of the world is they have no control. Their life is all about the circumstances around them, which, to be honest, is a terrible way to live life. Because how easy or hard is it to dictate and control circumstances? To be honest, it's really not that hard. I'm pretty sure I could tick any one of you off within 30 seconds. I'm pretty sure I could go to HEB, pick a stranger that I never know, don't even know their name, and make them mad like that. Well, the world teaches if someone makes you mad, then that's a bad day. Right? At the same time, I probably could make most people happy. If I go to the ATM, pull out $100, probably couldn't buy groceries for the rest of the week, but if I grabbed that $100 bill and I walked up to a stranger and handed it to him, do you think most of them would be happy? Yeah. See, what we've termed in the world is let the circumstances dictate your joy, your happiness, your feelings. And what God says is that's so foolish. Because the reality is you don't control those things. That's why we try to get money in our lives. It's not because we actually want to be rich. It's because money and richness gives us what? The sense that we control things. We think if I have money, I can have the best lawyers, I can have the best doctors, I can have the best healthcare, I have the best things. And so when life throws curveballs at me, I'll be ready to handle them. It'll give me control. But you know what the rich even learn? They can't control it. This world is simply beyond our grasps. And so what God points to is a happiness and joy that come not from the external, but from the internal. And once you have that, what you realize is if anything can happen around you, it doesn't change what's happening here. The second beautiful thing that's happening is not only is he preaching a message of happiness, which was absolutely not the way it was perceived by the people of that day. In fact, in Matthew 23, he addresses this. He's talking about the Pharisees here, and this is how he describes their use of religion. He says, they tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders. But they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. He describes their usage, the Pharisees' usage of the law, is somebody who gives a heavy burden and drops it on their shoulders. So instead of people feeling like God was this person that freed them, they felt like God was this person that restricted them. Now let's be honest, is it hard to do that? Not really, right? Go through the Bible and read the Ten Commandments. Do those feel like they free you or feel like they restrain you? Yeah, do not, do not, do not, do not, do not, do not, right? Ask any little kid in the toddler room if you start with do not, are they excited? No. Right? So it's very easy to feel that way if you don't see the bigger picture. And so he's starting first by going, this should be a source of happiness and joy. Don't you get that you who are rejected, God chooses? Don't you get those who are poor here on earth, you're going to get the kingdom of heaven? Don't you get you're going to receive mercy? Don't you get that those of you who are hungry and thirsting, God will give you everything that will satisfy you? He's showing them this should be something of joy. The second thing that's happening is he's flipping everything on its head. See, the conventional wisdom of the time stated that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. We see it in the Old Testament, we see it in the New. In the Old, go look at the book of Job. The book of Job starts with a beautiful thing where you and I hear a discussion between God and Satan. And so from the beginning of that, we know that God loves Job. In fact, God almost is bragging about him. Satan comes to him and God's like, have you seen my boy Job? This guy loves me. He's unbelievably righteous. He's a good man. And Satan goes, well, it's just because you give him everything. And so God says, Satan, go ahead, do your worst. Do as you will to him. And what starts to happen is terrible things happen in Job's life. He gets sick, his children die, his money goes away. All these bad things happen. And do you know what his friends start to say? Job, what sin did you commit to cause this? And Job's sitting there going, I didn't change anything. I've been living the same way I've lived. And their friends are going, mm-mm. Bad things are happening to you, so de facto, you must have done something bad. What'd you do, Job? For them, it's that clean cut. Bad stuff happens, you're a bad person. In the New Testament, we still see that prevailing logic. You'll see the disciples look at a person that's blind or crippled, and they'll look at Jesus and go, who sinned, him or his father, that he's that way? Oh, he's crippled. That means he's a bad person. What Jesus points out here is that's not the way it works. When sin entered this earth, it came in and it broke everything. Good stuff happens to bad people. Bad stuff happens to good people. It's chaos. Kind of reminds you of like a drunk bad man driving on the highway. He's not going to just wreck cars that have bad people in them. It's out of control. And so what's scary about this to the Pharisees is that this is attacking their system. Everybody had looked at the Pharisees as people who must have been godly. Why? They were rich. They were powerful. They were educated. That must mean good things are happening to them. They're good people. Vice versa, all these people following Jesus were outcasts and rejects, so they were bad people. See, Jesus looks at them and he goes, uh-uh. I call you to be part of the kingdom just like I call anyone. And what I love about that is, let's be real, we're probably in the reject group, aren't we? No one likes to admit it, but we're probably in the reject group. I don't know about you, but I haven't been on any Fortune 500 list of top people to watch out for. And I know what my bank account looks like. It's nothing too big there, right? But God looks at the people like you and me who have searched for religion to heal us. I mean, I know right now in this room, there are people I've talked to who have gone to churches seeking God's love, seeking acceptance, seeking warmth, and instead they walked in the doors, you know what they got? Judgment. Got a bunch of pharisaical people that looked at him and said, no, you don't dress right. No, you don't act right. No, we know what you've done in the past. Get out. Instead of being received in love and in warmth and compassion, instead, those who were seeking to not be rejected anymore in the one place they thought they would be accepted, God's house, were instead judged even worse. Well, God looks at those people and he goes, that's not the way it's supposed to be. My Father offers you what you're looking for. And trust me, once he gives you what he has, you'll find a joy in your heart that surpasses all other joys. You'll find a peace and comfort that can't be contained. He goes to those who've been pushed aside and says, you're mine. And see, that's the beauty of what God does, is he does amazing, beautiful, powerful things, not with the best of the best, but with the lowliest of the lowliest. In fact, what's glorious about this passage here is he's not even talking about the physical things. He's not even talking about worldly things. He's talking about the spirit. It says, blessed are the poor in spirit. So this is about what kind of car you drive, what kind of clothes you wear, about how much money is in the bank account. No, it's about the way that you perceive yourself. It's about when you look at yourself in comparison to God, do you go, yeah, I'm close? Or do you go, no. I'm so low it's not even funny. And there's almost a natural progression here, right? If you realize you're poor in spirit, it will cause you to mourn. And when you mourn, you have a meekness about you. And when you're meek and you're mourning, what do you seek? You hunger and thirst for things. And what happens? God provides. It says he will give you the righteousness that will satisfy you. He says that you shall receive mercy. You shall see God. You shall be called the sons of God. So it starts with these people who are poor and broken, and that is their identity. And what he says is, through faith, you become the sons of the richest, most powerful being in the universe. He's flipping everything upside down. The Pharisees used the law and God to keep people lowly. Jesus is going to use them to lift you up. He's going to use them to lift these people up. It says then in verse 13, you are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand. And it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is heaven. What is that saltiness? What is that light? It's that happiness. It's that joy that comes from your relationship with Christ. It should define you. It should be impossible to hide. Have you ever had that moment where like your phone goes off and you're in the movie theater and you can't hide the light? Right? You're like trying to smother it or whatever. You just can't, you can't block the light out. That's what he's describing here. You and I are supposed to be so in love with God, so in sync with His Spirit, so full of His power, that when we walk out, you can't hide it. It's impossible to ignore. People should look at us and go, they belong to Jesus, I know. Because why, they're glowing, look at them. It should be that evident to people that you're His. And you know what's beautiful? The people in the first century, it was. I told you this before. First century Christians weren't called Christians. They were called the people of the way. They lived in such a way that you could just look at them and go, oh, those people belong to Jesus. Those people belong to Jesus. And it wasn't because there was a fish on their car. It wasn't because Caleb was the number one preset. It was about the way they lived their life. Now, I want you to look at what happens here. Verse 17 is key. There's a question about Jesus that comes up in his ministry, and it is essential to who he is and to how we treat this entire book. Jesus comes in and immediately he's at war with who? The Pharisees and the scribes. Now if you look at the Pharisees and scribes, what were they dedicated to and what was their primary tool? The law. The Old Testament. And not just the Old Testament, but the laws that they had built on top of that. So as Jesus is gaining in popularity, as he is growing, one of the things that starts to become a question is how does Jesus, who seems to be presenting things that are completely new, respond to the law of God presented in the Old Testament? Does he hold to it? Does he acknowledge it? Does he honor it? And when you think about this statement, it's unbelievably profound. Why? Because if God is God and he is unchanging, well then should the Son of God come to wipe away what the Father did? No, absolutely not. Yet at the same time, if we've had thousands of years of this is how God's law works, and Jesus is coming to offer something new, how can it be the same? How can it be the same? It can't. In fact, as Jesus is growing in popularity, there were people who were waiting for the moment where he would throw the old law out. There was a group of Jews who believed that the Messiah, when he came, would wipe away everything old and start everything new. And they expected the Old Testament law to be part of that. The Pharisees, their number one thing that they continually were trying to catch Jesus in was him breaking Old Testament law so they could say, hey, clearly you're not from God. So the second thing of this sermon is Jesus is going to address the law. And I love how he does it. Look at verse 17. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass away from the law until all is accomplished. I love that. You want to know the answer to that question? Let me just tell you. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill. And fulfill what? Every single bit of it. Every cross T, every dotted I will fulfill. Does he leave any room for doubt there? Not at all. He has come to fulfill this law. He stands for what his Father has done. He says, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass away from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay, so remember that whole thing where Christians aren't supposed to offend people? Is Jesus following that here? No, he just, in a sermon, called out the Pharisees and the scribes. And that kind of called out, he just said, if your faith is like theirs, you're not seeing heaven. That's kind of a big one, right? I mean, that's not kind of like, hey, you guys are on the wrong path. No, it's you guys are not going to see heaven. So what I want you to see is happening here is he's doing exactly what he did in the temple. In the temple, he goes, this is my Father's house built to glorify him. I will not have you using it for your own wealth. Well, he comes to the Pharisees and he goes, this is my Father's law meant to glorify him, not to lift yourselves up. See, what the Pharisees did is they used these laws not to humble themselves, but to make themselves better than everybody else. Why do we deserve to be in charge of you? Why are we better than you? Because we follow these rules. The very rules that were supposed to make them realize how great and awesome God were, instead they used to make themselves look better. And God, Jesus goes, no more of that. That is not what this is for. And so then he goes into this discourse, and I'm not going to go through it all for the sake of time, but each of these statements start very much the same. He says in verse 21, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hells of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come on offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny." We're going to see him talk about anger, lust, divorce, and with each of them what he's going to say is, "You've heard it said this, I say this." And the difference that he will get to is he is more about the depth of heart. See, the Pharisees were about the rules and could care less what the motive or intention of them was. So they absolutely believed that the only thing that made me good was that I didn't murder you. But I could talk about you as a fool and a loser and a bum and how I hated you. That was okay. And Jesus goes, "You fools. Do you think that was what the law was for? Do you think the law was so that you could have all these ugly thoughts inside of you, but just because you didn't execute on them, that means you're good? Lust? You think it's just about adultery? No, I tell you, if you look on a woman with lust in your heart, you've already committed it." What he's doing here is he's reestablishing the purpose of the law, which was this. One, to make it more about who you are than what you act like. Do you get the difference between those two? Guess what? Anybody can fake it. Have you ever been at work where you're sarcastically saying all the right things? Anybody here, kings of sarcasm? I never use it in my house. A gradeless family never has used sarcasm at all. And that's not sarcastic, okay? Sarcasm is beautiful because are you saying the right words? Absolutely. Are you saying them with the right heart, intention, or tone? No. So can they capture you and get you on what you're actually doing? No. And that's how the Pharisees live life. The Pharisees didn't care about the heart of the matter. They didn't love people. They didn't love God. But they followed the rules. That's what they cared about. God goes to them and goes, "That's not what the purpose of the law was. You guys think it's just about how you act. And once you realize, when you make it all about action, you forget who God is. Can any single one of us earn heaven? No. Hey, you Pharisees, don't you see that when you make it all about action, that's what you're doing? When you make it all about following the rules, what you're truly saying by the way you live life is if I do these things, I'm good enough to get to heaven." And he tells them how foolish that is. See, the purpose of what Jesus does to the law here is he makes it clear how impossible it is to follow. He equates anger in your heart with murder. He compares lust in your eyes to adultery. By that case, which one of us isn't a murderer or an adulterer? None of us get by on that judgment. By those standards, each and every one of us is guilty of those sins. Now, why would God want that to be the case? Because he wants each of us to understand, are you good enough on your own? No. Are your actions ever going to earn your way to heaven? No. The law was there to continually point out to us, God is here, we are here. Yes, it's a way that we're supposed to strive to live in life, but we're supposed to bring about a humility in us that we understood that God who is perfect is so far beyond us. That's why we must humbly go to him. That's why we must sacrifice. That's why we must ask for mercy, grace, and forgiveness, because we can't possibly live to the standard of perfection. What the Pharisees did is unreal. They actually thought when they read the law, they could say, yep, we do all those. We're good. Think of the arrogance of that. To think that you could look at the standard of God and go, yep, I meet all those. I pass the bar. See, the beauty of what Jesus does is he comes in and he goes, I don't care about your traditions. I don't care about your man-made rules. I'm going to be revolutionary by taking you back to the original intent. I'm going to be revolutionary by calling you back not to what you've practiced, but to what God has called for from the very beginning. I want you to be a people that just don't look like you love God, but be a people that do love God. I want you to be new creations. I want you to be with Christ. I want you to be with God. And that is so much different than just acting like it. It's about a new and changed heart. In 1 Samuel 16:7, God talked about this very thing. When they were looking for a new king, the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. What does God see when he looks at your heart? What does God see when he looks into your heart and goes, where is Christ at? Has Christianity just become for us a religion? Is it just a way of life? Is it a set of rules where we think if we come to church and we do certain good things and we read this book, that means we're good enough and we're going to get to heaven? Or is all of this driven and motivated by a passionate, loving relationship with God? Is this about us pouring ourselves into him and going, I will pursue you, Father, wherever you go? You know what a Christian should look like? It should look like a person who's pathetically in love. Do you remember what it's like to be pathetically in love? I love teenagers for this. They're so clear about it. When they get that first crush, like, you don't have to wonder who they like, because that's all they talk about all the time. The whole world centers around that one person that they're infatuated with. They pursue them. They talk to them hours on end. I mean, I remember like just talking to my wife when we first met and we'd fall asleep on the phone. Nowadays, I get in trouble because I'm not even listening. I'm just going, uh-huh, 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 uh-huh. I mean, I remember those times where you just sit there and ask questions. What's your favorite color? What's your favorite food? What's your favorite movie? You sound like an idiot. But you know what you're reflecting? An unbelievable desire to know them in and out. I want to know it all. I want to know everything that makes you who you are, everything that makes you tick, everything that's you. I want to know that. When's the last time you displayed that kind of love for God? When's the last time you were just hungry to know him? When was the last time you woke up and go, I need God today? I have got to get some time with him. I have got to get into his word. I have got to know what he is saying. I hunger for it. I thirst for it. I need it. I don't need sleep. I don't need food. I don't need anything else. I just need him. That's what I need. See, the beauty is people who live like that, watch out. They're going to change the world. They're going to live in a way that sets a path of fire wherever they go. Problem with most of us is we approach a relationship with God like it's reading a phone book. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't do this. Don't do that. We come to church like it's a chore. We read the Bible like it's a chore. We sing songs like it's a chore. We do everything like it's I have to, not because I want to. And that's why the American church has completely lost its power. You know what's sad right now? Is we're actually, in the history of mankind, part of a new great awakening. All across the world, people are being saved left and right. We are seeing churches growing in places where persecution and atheism and other religions have thrived for years, centuries. But you know where it's dying? Here at home. Because it doesn't mean anything anymore. It's a religion, it's not a relationship. I want to share one last story with you and then we'll go. If your Bibles, flip with me to John chapter 8, verse 31. I'm sorry, John chapter 8, starting in verse 3. It says, the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now the law of Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say? This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground as they continued to ask him. He stood up and he said to them, Let he who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? She said, No one, Lord. And Jesus said, Neither do I condemn you. Go and from now on sin no more. I love this story because it shows the difference between Jesus and these Pharisees. The Pharisees drag this woman, and I want you to kind of just picture it for a moment. It's early in the morning. Jesus is already out teaching in a courtyard. This woman, it says, is caught in the act of adultery. So that doesn't mean before or after. It means during the actual events, she is caught, which most people read into this was a setup. They either knew the guy, they knew something was going down, but there's a way they knew that that was happening at that moment. They drag this woman in the act, out of the town, through the streets, and throw her at the feet of Jesus. Now the beauty of this story is it shows the Pharisees, do they care about this woman at all? She's probably got cuts and bruises from being dragged. She's probably half naked. She's been shamed in front of everybody. And now she's sitting at the feet of Christ and these men are calling for her head. And they say, Hey, Jesus, by the law of Moses, which, by the way, you say you belong to God, the same God that was the God of Moses, it says that we're supposed to stone such women. What do you say? The beauty of this trap they've set is it makes complete sense. They're pulling an Old Testament law, which Jesus should affirm. Yet if he follows through with it, well, he shows his alignment with Old Testament law. What he doesn't show is that he's not the friend of sinners, and the mercy and forgiveness and grace he's been talking about, well, that's out the window. He just called for a woman to be killed. And yet, if he says, forgive her, let her go, well, then clearly he doesn't align with Old Testament law, and he is turning his back on God's commands. Pharisees feel like they've built the perfect trap. What it shows you about them, though, is do these men care about people? No. And we know that because there's a million questions that you could ask. One, do you think this was the only adultery going on in Jerusalem at the time? Do you think this is how the Pharisees were treating every such case of adultery that they came across? No, we know it wasn't. Two, legally, did they have the right to kill anybody anymore? No, they were under Roman law. So the other beautiful thing about this trap was is if Jesus allowed her to be killed, you know what they would have run to and done? They would have run to the Roman officials and said, Hey, this Jesus, this rabbi, he just ordered a death, which she doesn't have the authority to do. It's a beautiful trap by them, but it reveals the truth. That these men, is this motivated by God's law? By their awe and respect of Him? No, it's driven by their hatred of Jesus Christ. Now, what I love about Jesus is there's these moments in life where human beings think they've caught God. There's these moments where they think they've outsmarted Him, found a loophole, whatever. They think they're going to get away with something. They apply that pressure tactic. Kind of reminds me, have you ever been with a car salesman? Right? You know when they're just trying to get you to sign quickly, right? Pressure tactics. Now, you got to make a decision now, 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 now. And you see it, they say, he keeps asking, what should we do, what should we do, what should we do, what should we do? And how does Jesus respond? He kneels over and starts playing in the dirt. Again, I love these things about Jesus. And I know they're kind of weird, but these are the things that reveal His personality. In the midst of what's chaos and a woman's life hangs in the balance, all this drama, and what does Jesus, the King of Kings, do? Bends over and starts drawing in the sand. Why? To two things. He's letting them know, you're not controlling the pace of this, I am. And two, in that moment that he draws in that dirt, what changes as far as everybody's perspective? Where do their eyes move from and to? Away from her and to him. And then Jesus makes a beautiful, beautiful thing. He looks at them and he goes, all right, well, the first one of you that has no sin, go ahead and cast the first stone. He doesn't tell them no. He doesn't tell them yes. He just simply says, well, according to God's law, those who are righteous, those are the ones that can cast the stones. So go ahead. Which one of you thinks you're righteous enough to cast judgment on her? What I love is you could just kind of imagine the silence hitting the crowd. And you see these men, they're literally standing there with stones in their hands. And it says, you know who drops them first? The oldest. The wisest, the graybeards sit there, they know what he said, they know how it will look, and they realize they've lost. He's flipped it and put it right back on them, and they just start dropping their stones and they start walking away. I love it visually because they walked in there in a mob, powerful, loud, boisterous, thinking they had won, that they had finally trapped him, and they walk away with dogs with their tails tucked between their legs, one by one. Sub message, don't mess with God, he's going to win. Okay? The beautiful thing that he shows here, though, is that he's willing to offer mercy and forgiveness. What he shows is that he is not going to be tricked by these men who are using God's law for their own intentions and not for the purposes that were originally given. Now, is this woman sinful? Absolutely. And does she need to be held accountable for what she's done? Absolutely. But Jesus already knows what his mission is, and his mission is to come not to condemn the world, but to save it. To offer forgiveness and mercy. And so after everybody else has cleared around, he looks at her and he says, is there no one here to condemn you? You know what's scary? There's one person who could have thrown a stone. There's one person who's absolutely righteous enough to cast that rock. And so he looks at her and he tells her, go and sin no more. He's not going to tell her that everything she did was okay, but he's also not going to bring down the wrath of God. What he's going to do is use God's word for the intention and the purpose that it had. Which is one, for us to acknowledge how amazing and awesome he is, and two, for it to show us a way to live life. This is the beauty of Christ. And what I love about him is, brothers and sisters, there's all kinds of things in this book that can be confusing and difficult. There's some passages you read that make you think one thing, and you read another passage and it makes you think another. And sometimes it's hard to put them all together. But what you see in moments like this is there's a God who knows how it works. And if you're patient and you're willing and you have a hunger and thirst to know him, he will reveal all those truths to you. You know, the beautiful thing about being in love with God is that excitement of getting to know him, it never dwindles. He's infinite. There literally is never the end to how many questions you can ask him. There's never a moment where you don't see him and go, you are awesome. There's never a moment where you don't realize that there are just volumes and volumes of more beautiful, awesome things to know about him. The beginning of this sermon is so powerful because what Jesus is saying to the Pharisees and to the crowd is, I'm not here for religion. I'm not here to push down upon you. I'm here to lift you back up. I'm not here to put some system upon you that restricts your life. I'm here to give you a love that frees you. I'm here to show you how to live. And for all of you that have been rejected, for all of you that have been opposed by fools that think they're better, there's a different way. There's another way. That's what he presents. Now, in the following weeks, we'll get to dive more into this sermon, which is unbelievably filled with wisdom and knowledge. But this sets the tone for what he's doing. He's come to flip it all upside down and go, we are going back to where we belong. Which is honoring the intentions of God. That's what we're going to do. Let's pray.